So the session that we're talking about today, the conversation we're having, is about the impact of your child experience sexual abuse or sexual trauma on you as parents and carers and other supporters. So we're going to be kind of thinking about secondary or vicarious trauma. I'm thinking about kind of some of the early responses you may have to discovering that this has happened and kind of managing the early days post-disclosure, as well as kind of thinking about some of the longer term adjustments that might come with this. Looking after yourself is super, super important. And as much as we fully acknowledge that this is the young person's experience, it's also an experience that you as parents and carers and other family members are having. And therefore, in order for you to care for your young people, it's really important that you get the support that you need as well.
Yeah, I think it was only after quite some time I realised how important it was to care for yourself. Because if you don't care for yourself, your child is going to pick up on that and they're not going to respond as well. If you're together. So for yourself and for your child, you need to make sure that your mental health is quite strong and you're looking after yourself.
I think for a long time it was really difficult to accept as a parent the word trauma in relation to yourself. I think it's quite difficult to know or to feel comfortable when you're trying to help your child navigate something terrible, that actually recognising what you're feeling and the impact on you are a trauma response. And in doing that, it can feel like you're taking away some of the attention and focus from your child. And that, you know, is not necessarily wrong, but it's equally as important to accept that these things are very difficult to digest, they're very difficult to hear. And that you have to take steps to protect your well-being, because if you fall apart, your young person, your child, has nobody there to look out for them.
I guess I didn't really take myself into consideration. And it was more about my child needs this, my child needs that. And then I kind of went into a burnout. And I found that the one thing that would kind of help me really was to sleep, and I would be sleeping during the daytime when I was taking my child to their counselling sessions. I would actually sleep in the car. It would just be an hour where I knew my children or my child was safe, and I used that time to just sleep. But it was mentioned within their counselling session that my child felt very lonely while I was sleeping. And so then I felt guilty for sleeping. So
did you then change it to sleep when your child was at school and stuff? You changed your way so you were always available for your child?
I just had to really explain that it wasn't something I could control, and it wasn't, you know, all. It was just my body's reaction to what had gone on, and I was like, you can, I'm still here, you know, if you need me for anything. But I just had to explain to them that I couldn't control it.
I suppose for me, then I think social support and negotiating that when it's not solely up to you who you can tell and what you can tell them, because obviously there's your child's needs and also possibly kind of legal needs as well. And I found building that kind of support, that kind of support, really difficult. And then I think another difficulty is for me was that I just sort of become hyper aware of trying to, rather than just, it's much harder to just have a normal interaction with my child, because because I'm just trying to kind of decode what's actually happening or what they're saying or what they're feeling all of the time in the light of this kind of new reality that I'm in, and that makes it harder.
Yeah, I think at the beginning I certainly found I was treading on eggshells and not being myself. And I think everyone knows a child needs routine as well. So them seeing you together, like generally you usually are, does help them in a big way. If they see you struggling, if they see you letting yourself go, that is very difficult for a child. So they need normality, as normal as it can be, normality, structure, routine. That will help your child a lot more than everything changing or you pussyfooting around them or, you know, so, yeah.
I think for me, I had the disclosure on the Friday evening, and obviously that weekend, you know, was just all in turmoil. But Monday morning it was, you have to go to school, I have to go to work, and so we're very routine as a family anyway. So I think following that routine, it was almost a case of, oh, okay, so this is how it's going to be. But then when I got to work, I had to tell someone. I didn't know, you know, who to kind of turn to. So I did go and speak to one of the managers who was, you know, really good. And she said to me, she said, what helped me? She said she went through something with her children. And she said someone bought them some Lego. And so she gave me money. She said, I want you to take them and go and buy some toys for them. It'd be like a completely new toy. And it completely took their mind. And it was just that kindness, I think. And it certainly made those first few weeks a bit more bearable. And, you know, for the children, they had, you know, new toys and things to play with.
So then that made it feel easier for you? Or it sounds like it was quite exhausting.
Yeah, I think when you know that there's things moving in the background, because at first it is all about what's happening next, where's the next appointment coming from? And, you know, so it was almost just to kind of like pass the time, really.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point as well, because you've got the initial upheaval and the kind of explosion of what's happened, and of course your child is your focus point at that time. But then it's, you know, as you're getting a bit further down the line, it's a lot of the parents that I've spoken to, it's very easy to be dismissive of your own needs and your own care, and it's all like, it's about my child. But of course, there's that, you know, the principle of, and you've already talked about that, if you don't take care of yourself as the main caregiver, then your child ultimately could end up being even more vulnerable because they've got no one to kind of be alongside them. So, yeah.
I think that just kind of, to me, resonates with the whole, as a parent, you feel like you've missed something, you've let them down. So to then feel selfish and say, I need to take some time for me, is really hard. And it's, you know, I remember sleepwalking through those first couple of weeks, months maybe, where you're just putting one foot in front of the other and you're not listening to what's being said, you're not retaining anything, you're just plodding. Some days are better than others. And you kind of felt a bit like putting on a show. You know, if anybody came around, everything's okay, and you're sort of smiling and, yeah, this is awful, isn't it? But it's okay because we're still here. And, you know, you kind of get dismissive about the impact, whereas actually you just, I don't actually quite know how we made it through that, because I don't think I've slept properly since, and I don't think I ever will now. It's habitual. It's been so long that years and years down the line, I still don't sleep properly. And that does have an effect on your mental health, on your ability to cope. But if you'd have said to me right at day one, you must look after yourself, I'd have said, no, 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 no. You know, I'm just not going to do that, because I've already missed something here that is huge. My child needs that support. It's not about us as parents. And it, you reflect back on it now and you can see absolutely, it screams out at you the things that you're going through, the symptoms you exhibited then that you still exhibit now. All of those things, I'm recognising it in your child. So we've been through that post-traumatic stress diagnosis and all of those things that you go through and you see those symptoms and you say, okay, my child is struggling and still struggling. Actually, you can recognise in yourself. Now, I couldn't then, and if you'd have told me at that time, well, people did tell you at the time, you know, you need to look after yourself, you need to eat, you need to sleep. I don't think I ate post-disclosure for about 4 days because I just couldn't, you know, stomach it, because it's just, well, it's a trauma response, isn't it? It's an implosion of everything that you think is normal, and you, that kind of vicarious secondary trauma is, that's not a comfortable label to put on it, I don't think, as a parent. I get it, but I find it quite difficult to see it up in black and white and say, actually, I've suffered things here, because did I go through it? No, I didn't. Yes, our family unit has changed, our world has changed, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't me that was being abused. So it's quite difficult to accept when you say vicarious trauma, that as a parent you've suffered trauma, but you absolutely have. Because if nothing else, you've listened to the one thing in the world that's most precious to you, saying the most awful things. And you missed it. As a parent, you missed it. So it is very complicated, I think.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's situation is different and depends on who the perpetrator was, etc. And who you would generally lean on as your support people. Because if the support people, like, you know, your family members, you know, were involved in some way, for example, you've lost a big chunk of people who you can turn to, and it is so important you confide, if you can, in a trusted friend or family member. Think wisely, but speak to a friend or trusted family member, because, you know, you will need the support. You will need the support. And as soon as you start to look after yourself and get it out and start to think rationally, it will become easier. I don't know if that's true. Become easier. It will make more sense. It will make more sense, and you can use more rational ideas.
Also, in terms of the response, I was obviously at a very different stage from my child, because it was in a case of historic abuse. It's something that they've been living with for a long time, and their trauma is kind of something they're living with. Whereas as a parent, it's a, you know, it's a shock, and you are kind of having to deal with that weekend of kind of, oh my God, the whole world has changed, and possibly some things have got a bit clearer, because maybe some things make more sense now. But I suppose for your child, their focus is on what effect this has had on you, and their kind of the worries that perhaps held them back in some way from saying this before. And I don't really know what I'm trying to say beyond that, but just that there is that difference between what their experience of trauma is at that time as something known, and for you, something kind of
unknown
and new.
No, you're absolutely right. I think you nobody expects this to be the thing that happens to your family today, do they? And you're absolutely right that our children have been living with that secret, and certainly in our family's case, we're told, if you tell anyone, you'll get taken away, or this will happen, or blah, 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 blah. And then there are a lot of techniques used to control them. So they then tell you, and through their head, they're kind of thinking all these awful things are going to happen. So there's a lot of, in that very early initial stage, I think my daughter was looking to us to kind of reassure that everything was okay. And actually, that's the hardest thing to do when actually you don't know that everything's going to be okay, yeah. because you've got the police sat in your living room and you've now got a social worker that's coming from child protection to look at, is everything okay? Is everything safe? And all the while, you're also processing yourself what just happened. So it's a very, very odd situation to be in. And you're absolutely right that talking to people, I mean, we were encouraged to find support by the police officer that was investigating the case. We thought very carefully about who that was, because kind of conscious, it's a very heavy gift to receive. So can those people cope with it? Can I expect, if I tell a friend, for her to not tell her partner? How will they feel about it? What happens if their kids have had contact with the perpetrator? Do you know what I mean? There's so many 6 degrees of separation that go on that it's not just as simple as sharing, you know, oh, my son got beat up at the park last week, which you could quite comfortably share with your friends, your boss, the neighbour down the street, and it would be out there and known, and everybody would be, you know, kind of empathetic. When you're talking something like this, people find it very uncomfortable, find it very difficult to carry that burden with you. And also being conscious that once it's out there, you can't take it back. Yeah. So it's your child's story. It's, you know, so it feels quite selfish to kind of say, I need support and talk to somebody, because it's not your story to tell in many ways. It's theirs. And once somebody knows that about them, they will always know that about them, and you can't take it back. So it is a case of being very selective, because you don't know how things are going to play out down the line.
I think that's probably a regret of mine, is when I did speak to people about it, that I would have expected a bit of support from, just for me personally. And when you kind of didn't get that, it was like, I wish I hadn't have said anything. So I was kind of coming at it from a different way. But then I did find that when there was people that I'd spoke to, they were then able to tell me about trauma that they had experienced as a child. And it was then being able to relate then to how my child might be feeling, because I was listening to an adult tell me what they had experienced as a child, but put myself then in their shoes. So I think the more that I was able to talk about it, and as time went on, it did become a little bit easier. It was the more I was able to speak to selective people, the better help then I was able to give my child.
I think that's why the greenhouse is so important, because there are always people like-minded that are in similar positions. And it's, you know, if you can get on one of the parenting courses or groups like this, they're great for bouncing ideas off people and just airing exactly how you're feeling and getting tips from other people.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure how to say it before, but going back to that Friday or Thursday in my case, then I think just hearing that about what happened to your child and just feeling this kind of overwhelming sense of love for them and about, you know, about how much pain they must have been in and not been able to kind of to tell you about it. And it's also quite difficult as well, because obviously, you know, they're precious and you don't want to kind of make things worse. But I think one of the things that I kind of feel like I probably got right was to try and kind of just don't put anything in the way of that love, and just kind of actually, yeah. I mean, the other side of it is that it, you know, you get a bit kind of, that's part of the kind of working out exactly what they're thinking at the time and everything as well. But
I was probably the other side of that, where I completely freaked out and was just, everything was kind of like unbelievable. And yeah, I just remember just there wasn't one part of me that didn't believe what was being said, which was, you know, one thing I still look back on now, and I'm glad that there was no question at all. And it wasn't, I wasn't questioning my child, you know, is this true? It was, I need to kind of get to the bottom of this. But yeah, I just freaked out.
Yeah, I mean, with me, it hit me incredibly hard straight away, obviously. But for a little while after, I started to question myself because I didn't feel the need to go and get retribution off the perpetrator. And before any of this happened, I was always under the impression anyone touches my child in an inappropriate way, I'm going to kill him or I'm going to beat him up. And that didn't come. And I spoke to the main policeman that we were dealing with, and he just said, that's instinct, and your instinct is to go straight to your child, to protect your child. And the more I thought about it, yeah, he wasn't important. He's not important. What's important is getting my child better and loving her and getting her better. So, yeah, it's, the love will come out, I think. It not remind you how much you love them, because you always do, but it puts into stark reality how precious they are. And,
yeah. Did you worry afterwards about if you were to bump into this person? Because I know that was something I would have to drive past the road that I knew they lived on, and I made it quite clear to the police and social services that they may end up on the bonnet of my car. And they were like, oh, you're not allowed to say that. I was like, well, I just did, so my conscience is kind of now clear. But, yeah, that was always a worry of mine, that what if I do bump into that person?
Yes and no. I think because right from the offset, my focus was surprisingly not on him. It was straight on my daughter, and that hasn't wavered. If I saw him in the street now after all these years, I would shake, more than likely. I wouldn't do anything. At the very least, I would look at him, and the look I would give him would be enough for him to think, I need to steer clear of where I am right now, just in case I bump into him again. But yeah, he's not important. He's completely irrelevant. He's done the damage. We're picking up the pieces, and my daughter's moving forward. So that's important. He's not important. Nothing can ever change what's happened. So don't afford the perpetrator your, you know. It's quite strange that I haven't forgiven him, don't get me wrong, but he's not important.
I go for healthy avoidance. Anywhere he might be, and I'm just not interested. Not because I think he's going to end up on the bonnet of my car. I might just throw up on him, which, you know, is bonus. But I don't need that level of intrusion. And I don't want to see them. I don't want to have to deal with that. So I've just gone for a complete, I will drive out of my way to not go anywhere near, just because I don't need the hassle in my day, to be honest. But you're right, it's not about them. It's about focusing on the child.
It's strange because it would never have been a route I would have needed to have taken had it not been for certain road closures on my way to work. So I was literally being directed past the road, and it was like, oh, I don't know how long after it was, but yeah, I just remember having this fear, like, what do I do? What do I do if? And I'm kind of like a pre-warned sort of, what was it they say? Forewarned. So I was like, will I be in trouble for doing this? Probably not.
I think that's why you need a support network, for somebody to say to you, don't do that. Or maybe just drive a different way. Or it's really healthy to feel that level of rage, but let's not do anything with that. Let's park that and divert and do something different. You know, it's normal to feel all those things. The difference between good people and bad people is good people feel the things and don't do anything with it. Bad people cross the line when they know they shouldn't. And that's the difference. So I don't feel the need to spend any time at His Majesty's pleasure.
But to this day, and we're talking probably 10 years now down the line, I've not once needed to break my car suddenly, so that's a good thing.
So we have a slide on regulation. And with this slide, because you are supporting the young person or the child, and it's just how we talk about and think about ourselves and taking care of ourselves at the same time, I think you've said previously that as the parent you might feel really selfish to be thinking about yourself and your responses and your feelings. And I don't know, I always think of, what's that thing in the plane where you have to put on your own mask before you can even start to think about saving anybody else? So the first slide is about how we manage our own emotions and help us to get into the right state so that we respond to our child's emotions in the most helpful way that we can. So there is self-regulation, something that you might find that you would have to do so that you're able to have the conversations with your child, which would then lean into co-regulating. So you could co-regulate with your child, and then external regulations as well.
I think I found it incredibly difficult to not be able to pick times when issues were discussed, because I'm a very organised person when it comes to timings, for example. So if my daughter was coming up and you could see she needed to talk to you, she was trying to either ask questions or just be close, sometimes before this ever happened, it would be just give me 10 minutes or I'll see you later about that. And it's very difficult having to change the way you actually are, where you can drop everything and, you know, get into the position where you are in a position to receive your child's needs, really. So that will come with time. So I think just recognising that it's going to be a change on how you organise yourself. You need to get your head around that.
I think in the early days after disclosure, being available on demand is kind of how you get through it and helps your child or young person to offload. And if they've been holding something in for a very long time, they need to get it off their chest. And as an adult, you're probably better equipped to deal with it than they are. Doesn't feel like it sometimes. But as time moves on and that initial shock kind of recedes a little bit, I found it quite helpful to try and set some time aside so that she would know, I'll be available at this time with no distractions, nothing else is planned. And it didn't always work out that way, but just to try and manage it so that I wasn't getting a download right before bedtime. So then it just whizzes round and round in my head. It's very much about trying to find a time or, a technique that helps them say what's on their mind, because it's better out than in, but in a way that doesn't overwhelm you as a parent.
I think that will depend as well on the child's age group and their understanding of, can I have 5 minutes, and making sure that it is only 5 minutes, or can we talk about this later? So depending on their age group, I think during that initial disclosure time, it is important to them and you that if there's something that needs to be said, you think, well, I might need to write this down. And whatever it is you're doing, you automatically know it's not as important as what might be told to you next. So you do just turn the cooker off, or, you know, turn your program off, or, you know, whatever it is you're doing at that time. And you're like, right, okay, what is it that you need? How is it that I can help you? And then I think over time, your child then kind of comes to their own way of dealing with ways of being able to speak. So I know my child would always say, oh, Mum, do you want to go for a drive? And I knew that's when they wanted to discuss things with me. So I'm like, yeah, and we would just drive usually on an evening and not really going anywhere in particular, but yeah, just go for a drive. So we just had that time in the car with just us.
And I think it's also important to recognise when your child is struggling, and, you know, step in and ask questions, ask if they're okay. However, sometimes all your child needs to hear is, yeah, it is crap, isn't it?
Yeah.
They don't want answers. They just want some. They just want you to acknowledge that everything's crap sometimes.
Yeah.
And that is very helpful. But recognise when your child, what level they're at. If they're, you know, just all over the shop or calm, picking those moments and speaking to them in a calm time is a lot easier than speaking to them when they're flying off the handle. You need to get to a calming stage before anything will be worthwhile.
And I suppose it's not just about talking as well. There's also, you know, I mean, like you're saying about going for a drive, going for a walk is something that I do, and, or, you know, kicking a ball around, or just spending time, but that sort of spending time alongside each other is, and I suppose there's a sort of, yeah, maybe that builds into a routine.
Would you talk when you walked, or would you just literally just walk?
Yeah, I mean, not talk. I mean, my child doesn't really want to talk about things. So it's, but, you know, it's spending time with each other, and part of that, you know, co-regulation of just being alongside each other and
is enough.
And all those other kind of communications that happen as well.
It feels like you're talking about, you know, the slide that's coming up is containment. So it's about meeting your child where they're at and being able to help to hold really difficult stuff, isn't it? Difficult emotions, and sometimes words are not enough or are not the right thing. So what you just said about being alongside and finding ways to help process that, and that's what regulation's about. Because if we can't have some containment of our own emotions and somebody to do that with us and for us, then it's very difficult to be that person or container for your child.
Yeah. I remember actually my child spending an awful lot of time out on the trampoline, and they could be out there for hours in all weathers, and it didn't matter. And I knew if I had visitors come to the house, they'd be like, oh, why are they outside? It's raining. It doesn't matter. They're outside, and whatever they are doing, it's distracting them enough that this is their freedom. This is their time to kind of maybe do their own self-regulation. And yeah, it was a case of, unless it was thunder and lightning, I need to come in.
I think for us, it was a very, we were always very open with our daughter about the particular case, the issues, the visits that were coming up, what was being said. But I think there was an awful lot of, in order to contain and regulate myself, it was being really conscious about not flying off the handle and letting everything fall apart while she was awake. You kind of have to wait until, which is not easy when they don't sleep. But yeah, it's making sure that you've got that time where you can let it all out, because a lot of the time you're trying to be really conscious about what do you say in front of them? What do you talk about? Do you acknowledge, how far do you acknowledge, yeah, this is really rubbish, but you know, or what if, and, you know, all of these things that go around in your head, it's trying to contain that so you're not projecting that onto them, when actually what they want is just to know that you're okay and normal.
You have to obviously understand as well and realise that they still are kids and they've got kids' thoughts. So one day, without you knowing, they could just not want to talk about it at all. Just because it's on your mind doesn't necessarily mean it's on their mind. And they might want to just do their kids' stuff, want to go to the park, want to go swimming, whatever it is. And so you need to seize on those times and do what they want to do in that moment.
Yeah, and thinking about the trampolining, sometimes what your child does for self-regulation may not be something that you would do or even approve of, and that's quite hard to get your head round. And I'm not sure I've really managed to do it, but those things like, you know, gaming and YouTube, I don't know, you know what, but that isn't a problem.
But it's helping them.
But it's the sort of this sort of space that people go in, that your child goes in, but to you, it might be something that you kind of disapprove of. But I don't know how you negotiate that, because on the one hand, you are supposed to be kind of trying to help them not get too deep. I don't know.
I think whatever it is, it seemed to bother other people more, the fact that, you know, my child was out in the rain. And, you know, they weren't bothered the fact that it was raining or cold, you know, in half an hour, whatever, you're going to come in and have a nice bath and get your pyjamas on and ready for bed. And so, yeah, it was, we were probably a little bit different within our house, because I am quite a fly off the wall type of person. And I think if I'd have acted any different, my child would have been like, oh, something's not kind of right. So it was almost a case of me having to be completely honest with my child. And if them asking me, why are you crying or why are you upset, it was to then speak to them from my point of view and saying, you know, I'm upset for you, or you look sad today, or I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed. And so I think just the level of respect that we all had within the house for one another, and however everyone was feeling, it was okay to feel like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It depends on your family setup, really, but we were completely honest. And if I was feeling crap and she could see I was feeling crap, that's the way it was. And, you know, you protect them as much as you can, but you've got to be yourself as well, otherwise.
But you're also role modelling the fact that you can have all these big feelings and you can let them out, and some days you don't get it right, but actually tomorrow you get up, you put your clothes on, you go work, you do your job, they go to school and you carry on. And it's okay to have moments where you're not feeling the best, but to ignore it or suppress it or pretend it's not happening is not healthy.
Yeah, or even in the past, even pretend it didn't happen yesterday in a way. I don't know, apologising for when you did mess it up a bit the day before. And
that's really hard as a parent, isn't it? When you have to say, I got that one wrong.
Yeah.
It's healthy, and you always encourage your kids, if they've upset someone, to say, I know you didn't mean to, but, you know, you've upset little David, you should probably say sorry. Yeah. So you kind of encourage your kids to recognise when they've upset someone. But it's really hard, it's really uncomfortable when you have to put the boot on the other foot and say to your kids, yeah, Mum got that one, got it a bit wrong yesterday, should we start again?
Yeah.
But that's probably the most helpful thing you can do.
Yeah,
definitely. Which brings us on to the next slide around code of regulation, which Naomi was talking about earlier, how we model our emotions with, and our nervous system will respond to the young person. If you think about when you have a really tiny baby and they want to be soothed, and you respond to them, you're not always going to get it right. So you're, okay, have they got a wet nappy? Have they got this? So it is about the whole reciprocity of the situation, the give and the take. And sometimes you are going to get it wrong, and sometimes you're going to get it completely right, and it's going to go amazingly. But I think it's around, a bit like what you were saying, how do you come back and say, oh, maybe that was not how I wanted that whole situation to end. And then you reframe and you come back again, a bit like you said.
Showing your children that something positive can come out of a negative, and in the widest sense, this is a really negative situation and experience for those young people. So showing them that you can rebuild, you can move through it, you know, it's not always easy. We always talk about it being like a bereavement. You know, it's not a linear pathway. Some days you're up, some days you're down, you're further along, and then you have a setback. And helping them to understand, and so especially when a lot of the professionals and institutions around them almost behave like it was a broken leg, and now it's done, it's healed, that was ages ago, move on. And for children, that can, and for adults actually, that can be quite difficult to process, that, well, everyone's telling me that it was a long time ago and I should be okay today, and I'm just not, or something's set me off or triggered me, you know. So helping them to understand and say it's okay, you know, it's not, nobody's expecting everything to be perfect. This might be, it might, you know, settle down, and it does settle down. To begin with, it's all consuming. And then, you know, it kind of, you go through that period where it's a bit and, you know, things happen, and then something else crops up, and then it comes back to bite you. And then, you know, I think somebody described grief once as like glitter, throwing glitter in your room. Like you vacuum most of it up, and then one day you turn over a cushion and there it is, you know, and you don't know that it's hidden until it's not hidden. And then you've got to kind of clean that bit up, and then you'll, so it's not fixed one day. It's never fixed wholly, because you can't undo what's done, but you can help them to understand that it doesn't define them, and that you, and you role model that as parents by saying, this doesn't define me as a parent. I think absolutely has affected the parent that I am versus the parent I might have been. How do I know what that is? I don't. How do I know what she would have been had this not happened?
Yeah, I mean, my life and our lives are completely different. I guarantee you they're completely different to what we would be doing. Not just, obviously not sat here, but because of the situation, because of the people involved, you know, our daughter would not be doing the things she's doing now. And some of it, brilliant. She's forged a path and she's doing exactly what she's doing. She wouldn't have done that if what has happened. You know, there'd be a lot more people in our lives. We'd have different friends. Would have, you know, so life changes. And I think getting your young child to see that, you know, what they've had is not what they're going to have is an incredibly difficult thing, but that will come.
You know, have to be hopeful, though, don't you? You want them to be hopeful and to help.
Yes.
For them to be hopeful, it's not, they have to see that you're hopeful that this won't always be. It is right now, it's all consuming, but tomorrow it might not be. Mm. And then, you know, you move forward and you want them to see there's a future and a positive outcome. I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but that something good can come from something terrible. You know, I think if this hadn't have happened, would we all be sat here talking to each other and, you know, getting to know each other? You wouldn't have had that.
You'd have no awareness of what other people have to go through, and how, sadly, how common this actually is, because when it happens to you, you feel so alone. And I think that was probably like the worst feeling for me. It's no one will ever understand this. And until I come to the greenhouse, I hadn't met any other parents who, you know, were able to disclose that this had happened to them. All I knew was, you know, people that had disclosed their past trauma. So I was able to help my child from that perspective, but no one would then get it from my perspective. But it is, unfortunately, such a common thing that just doesn't get spoke about. It is the taboo.
What's the arrogance of this doesn't happen to a family? I said it out loud to the police.
I said it to the policeman.
This doesn't happen to families like ours. And he said it absolutely does. And when you are on this, you know, part of this infamous club that we're all in as parents, you know, you realise how many services are out there and how many different professional bodies there are. So that tells you there are a lot more people affected by this than are speaking up. And that's a really depressing and comforting thing in equal measure, I suppose, isn't it? That you know you're not alone, but you don't know who they are. It's hidden and it's secret, and it's finding places where you can be.
I think statistics need to be spoke more about, especially where schools and that are concerned, because I found the school very unhelpful towards me. And again, it was that feeling so alone, and you're thinking, I'm not the only person to have gone through this school year, or that, you know, for this to happen to it. It just, there would be other parents in that situation at some point, or maybe not that year, but previously. And so, yeah, I think the statistics will shed light on how many people are affected. And that's just those that are disclosed.
I think we talk a lot about guilt and shame, and how that can be very isolating for parents, and how they can be very common responses after the abuse. So after the disclosure, after the abuse, you have the shame where you don't want people to know, and then also the guilt around the fact that I think I probably should have seen what was happening.
Oh, that's very real. Yeah. I should have known. Why didn't I know? How? And you look back and you see signs of little things, and then you infer bigger kind of connotations on them. But the reality is people don't expect this to go on under their nose. You don't live your life thinking that you're, you know, married to an axe murderer, or, you know, your neighbour next door is doing whatever they're doing. You know, you don't live your life that way. It's not normal.
If it's not in front of you, you're oblivious. Completely oblivious. We were completely oblivious to it. And still to this day, even though I've been told countless times, you're not to blame, you wouldn't have known, I still should have known. I still should have known.
I think.
But I know I shouldn't have, but I've still got that inside me. And that is something that will haunt me, I think. And
you got to learn to live with it, though.
You have to learn to live with it.
You can either, you know, unpack and live there, which is not a pleasant place to be, or you can kind of pass through and think, this is not very nice, and then think, put your rational head back on and try and move past that. Because you're right, the guilt and the shame are incredibly isolating. And, you know, you as a parent, you've got all of these professionals asking you to relive the most awful part of your parenting journey, and probably the most awful part of your life, let's face it. And you're not even the one that's been through the abuse, you know, and you're asked to relive it day in, day out. There's always something going on, and it's really difficult to keep building yourself up to have those conversations, to go into these meetings at school or with the police or wherever you're going, or social services, and not in the back of your mind thinking, they're looking at you thinking, how did you let this happen? How did you not know? You know, and the reality is we didn't. And until you get that disclosure bomb that goes off. And I don't think unless you've been through this, you can empathise, but you can't understand that you can.
Yeah, I think another potential source of guilt, as well as I should have known, is they should have been able to tell me as well. But obviously, as we all know, there's a lot of very complex reasons why that often doesn't happen.
I think the problem is there's so much out there about stranger danger, and you teach your kids stranger danger. And in these instances, again, this is where the statistics need to, you know, become a factor in things. It's not a stranger that's doing this. It's people that's in your day-to-day life that you would never have imagined that this could happen, or, you know, even if there's certain services and that involved, they're not disclosing, oh, well, that person might actually turn this way and you need to keep an eye on this. It's not stranger danger. It is.
Yeah, that's what, that's one of the conversations I had with a policeman about, just how shocking it was. Not necessarily shocking it was that my daughter had this happen to her, but equally as shocking is finding out it was someone very, very close, and it had happened for a long, long time, and it happens under your nose, and it's just how did it happen? And the only thing I can say is he was a very clever person, and the manipulation, getting our daughter to not say anything, prevented her from speaking. And it was as easy as that. Otherwise she would have said something. But one thing that I always remember of our daughter was, she said one day, I wish I hadn't said anything, because everything he said has come true since. I don't get to see my family. I don't get to do this. I don't get to do that. So if I hadn't disclosed, I still would be seeing my family. And, yeah, you've got to obviously...
That's really hard to hear.
It's really hard to hear. Yeah,
really hard.
Yeah.
But you can't put the genie back in the bottle.
No.
So once it's out, it's out. And you just have to navigate your way through it. And I kind of feel like we've taken a bit of a real negative kind of, and it's easy to get stuck down there. It's not what you want. You don't want it to all be negative. I think it's really important to counteract that guilt, to counteract that shame. One of the most powerful things was finding some joy in every day. No matter what it is, it can be the sun shining. It can be, oh, look, there's a bird out there. It can be, I'm going to buy myself a cake. Personally, I supported the economy by internet shopping. That was my emotional crutch. I don't smoke. I don't really drink. I do eat a lot of cake. But shopping, did a lot of shopping, made me feel better about it. And as long as it's healthy and within reason and you're not causing yourself other problems, you know, you've got to find some joy in that time and don't feel guilty about laughing. You know, I think you feel like people are going to judge you if you laugh. And, you know, I think that's why we like coming here, because we do laugh a lot. About all sorts of things, and there's never a, well, you shouldn't be laughing because your child's going through something horrific. You know, it's,
you need to be normal.
You need that normality.
I think for me, my outlet was, initially I wanted to buy a bottle of wine, and as someone who doesn't really drink, I'm glad I kind of stopped myself thinking, no, if you go down that route, it's going to be a very bad road for you to go down. And as a coffee drinker, I then went and done the most British thing I could do, and I made myself a cup of tea. And it turned into, and I can laugh about it now, because it turned into almost like an addiction for tea. And it was a lot healthier than, you know, turn into a bottle of wine. And I'm kind of glad that I did that. And I'm glad I didn't shop loads, because that could have caused other complications.
I suppose I think about, in terms of the perpetrators, it not being that they were really clever, but that they were merciless in being able to exploit a sort of power imbalance.
Yeah, I think when I said that they're cleverer, it's clever as in I held this person when the day they were born, and he manipulated us as well. And that's, it's very clever for someone to be able to do what they did for such a long time and cover their tracks and then to stand up in front of a judge and just be completely expressionless. It's just a clever, clever person. Evil, but clever.
I think that was the hard thing for me, was knowing that another child has done this to your child, and then, you know, some people believe in your side of the story, some people wanting to believe their side of the story, and, you know, that was really difficult for me to kind of navigate through, and it is where the guilt and the self-blame and that comes from. But then you know that your child, you know that you're going to believe in your child, but even when they were presented with, you know, the facts and comments, and again, how cold this person was. I always remember that comment being made in one of the reports, how cold and emotionless this other child was. And then you start thinking, how has no one else seen this? But you just don't.
You don't see it because you're not looking for it.
No.
Simple as.
And if you lived your life looking for it, you'd have a very sad and sorry existence.
Yeah.
I don't think you want anybody to feel like they should have seen it. Any parent shouldn't feel like they should have seen this coming.
No.
No.
It you just shouldn't, you know. That regret, that guilt, that shame, that will always be there.
It's natural.
It's a normal reaction, right? But you shouldn't.
Doesn't mean it's right.
No, it doesn't mean it's real, you know, that's what should have happened.
Yeah, it's just one of the things that us as parents have to live with. And as I said, I will always live with it, but that's just another.
You live with it, you don't let it consume you.
Yeah, I've learned to not let it consume. Yeah, not let it consume you. It is a long road and a lot of talking, a lot of therapy, but. Yeah, things are getting more clear.
What's it they say, all roads lead to the greenhouse, is that right?
That's right.
So you've spoken quite a bit about some really big emotions that as parents and carers you have to hold after the disclosure and the journey that you have through the abuse, but I think we need to focus back on ourselves and how it is that we are kind to ourselves. We show ourselves self-compassion, what it is that we do for ourselves so that we are able to regulate these young people that we have in our lives and these children, and what it is that helps us. Maybe it's mindfulness, maybe it is finding your own community, maybe it's caring for others. I don't know what your experiences have been.
I think initially, having another child in the house forced a sense of normality. Mm. You have to, because they were not involved. There was no, they didn't have a clue what was going on, and we needed to keep it that way. So it was, that sense of normality allows you to function. I don't think I really got to the stage of self-care until it's a little way down the track, actually. You kind of do things to just keep going until burnout, really. And I think you probably will hit rock bottom before you can pick yourself back up again. Finding the support of some very trusted friends was really important, to be able to talk openly without judgment and just say whatever was on my mind. Sometimes that was pretty dark stuff. Sometimes it was, oh, this is just what's happened today. Can you just help me organise that a little bit and what I'm going to do with it? Because I can't process it and make it into any sort of sensible order. I think as parents, I was quite lucky. If I was feeling really rubbish, I could tag my husband in and he would take the reins for a bit, or depending on the task, we would divide quite often by task and look at who was best placed to deal with any particular situation. But that kind of joy or permission to feel normal happened really late on, after the criminal justice process was concluded, after we'd been through quite a lot of, you know, different hurdles along the way. I did have some therapy. not quite sure how I feel about it. You know, it helps some people. I don't think I was maybe in the right space, or it just didn't fit for me. Where I found my journey kind of kicking off was coming to the greenhouse, meeting other people that kind of got it, that are very different, but all the same in many ways. And from there, you were allowed to feel relief, laugh without judgment. And then from there, you can kind of go, oh, this is what it's like to feel sort of normal for half an hour. You know, and then from there, you kind of go, oh, I want a bit more of that, because you know it's healthy for you, it's healthy for your family. And then you kind of move on from there.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that helped me and still helps me is the ability just to, as sad as it sounds, just be quiet in a room on my own. That's what really helps. And that just gives you the chance to think and just put everything into perspective, come up with an internal plan, and, you know, no one's questioning and you're not having to talk about it. You could just think about it. And obviously, you know, all the other normal stuff that you do, that's great. But specifically for me, that is one thing that really, really helps, is just being quiet in a room or in a park, on a bench, wherever it is, and just not talk, just think.
Yeah, and sometimes not listening to music or reading or just...
just nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't actually do any of those things. I couldn't watch telly. I'm not a big music lover anyway, but even just being in the car, I found that quiet time in my car where I'm on my way to work and I've got no one to sort ready for school, or, you know, no one needs me right now. And it was like, now I can kind of process however I may be feeling that day. But yeah, I couldn't watch TV apart from, actually, and I'm ashamed to say, Love Island.
Oh, yeah, dare.
I'm judging you for that.
Thank you, but I had never seen it. And my friend who watches, we can judge her for watching the programmes she watches. She said, well, why don't you watch this? And it was, awful. Excuse me for saying, it was so crap, it was good. Because it just meant that you could just zone out and you're just watching nonsense. But it passed the time.
Whatever works.
It was what you needed at that time. It's going to be different for everybody, isn't it?
Unless you're still watching it, in which case we will continue to judge you.
I have just watched it. Yeah, I am ashamed to say. It's not as good as what it used to be.
Yeah, that's what my daughter says.
I think the interesting thing for out of all of this is the kind of, what I found most cathartic, actually, is leaving things in a bit less rubbish state than when we found it. So helping other people and using those experiences, knowing how isolating it is, knowing how awful it is, and then trying to turn that into something positive. So it's not all been for nothing. It's not all been wasted, all of those hours of crying and sitting up all night and, you know, turmoil. Being able to turn that into something that might help somebody else, even if it's just to know we know, you know, but to kind of use it to put some resources together to try and tackle these issues that have been so difficult to navigate. And I realise I'm in a privileged position because not everybody has the strength, has the support, has the time, has the just the sheer stubbornness to say, no, this is not how it's supposed to go, and to do something. But that's been really helpful for me to kind of, through that process, find loads of other people that have had equally as difficult times. And we all look at each other and say, well, that's not right. That's not how it should be. But to use it to make something positive kind of sticks two fingers up to the whole situation and says, actually, you won't keep us down. You're not going to keep us quiet. And we can change things. And I wish we didn't have this experience. I wish we weren't in this club, and I wish we'd never met in the most blunt terms, because I do wish anybody to be sat in the chairs that we're sat in right now. But what I do know is that through all of our experiences that we've been able to share, the next set of parents that come through or set of carers that come through will know that they aren't alone, and they won't spend months sitting there going, why is this happening to me? Why am I the only one? Because they will know that they're not. They might not be strong enough to get up and walk through the door. They might not be strong enough to out themselves as being those parents. But from the privacy of their own homes, they will know that other people are actually sitting here going, yeah, us too.
We know.
And I think just by listening to this, whoever's listening to this, you've taken a step, and just this will help you. But if you can, get involved. Help others. Crochet or something.
Oh, I knew it was going to get brought up. So, yeah, I was fortunate enough to kind of have a few crochet items within my house. So around disclosure time, I had just learned how to crochet, and I kind of crocheted something and nothing. As you've recently found out, it's a lot of nothing. But one thing that did actually help was when my child went through their counselling sessions, I was kind of eager to know how it had gone, or at least how they were feeling after. And I come up with the idea of making a blanket. And we had colour codes for how they felt after each session. So one colour meant that they felt really happy. One would be, you know, I feel a bit sad or I'm angry. And so each week I would crochet a different colour based on what I was told, this is what the colour needs to be. And then to see that kind of grow over the 24 weeks and have, you know, all these different colours, and then you can see parts that they've really struggled with, but then they've come through it and so they're happy again. And for them to be able to follow that, yeah.
That's lovely.
But it was never finished.
That's probably right there.
I like the fact that it's unfinished as well. It's kind of like, I'll have to try and dig it out and see if I can take a photo. But yeah, just this like unfinished blanket.
Yeah, it's probably a very kind of laden item, isn't it, that you wouldn't want to just put on your bed.
No.
I like the fact it's not finished.
Yeah.
Because I think the journey is ever finished. You don't ever reach a destination and go, oh, that's completed that.
Yeah.
You know, it's an ongoing process that evolves. And, you know, I think from our point of view, I look at where our daughter is now and I'm amazed at what she's achieved and how far she's come and how strong she is. And I think a lot of that is because we as parents were able to kind of provide that early support while she was waiting for professional help, while she was, you know, stuff was going on at school, being able to be available and constant and reassuring and set the boundaries when she was being a normal kid, you know, she's a good way through that recovery process. Is it perfect? No. Does she have bad days? Absolutely. Will there always be something that we have to live with? Yes. But she's getting up, she's going out there, and now she's finding her voice and she's doing what she's comfortable with, you know, to kind of tell her story or, you know, and that's not for everybody. I don't think what we're saying is you all have to be advocates, you all have to be out there being vocal, being visible, because that's really difficult. You've got to find what works for you, and that might be doing something physical, it might be doing something creative, it might be sitting in a room and doing nothing. All of that's okay.
I think there's a lot to be said for finding what works for you. And for me, it was crocheting something, nothing. I also liked doing bits of Lego because you are doing something where it's taking your mind off of, you know, whatever it's been running around in your mind that day, even if it's just 10 minutes is a 10-minute break, whereas I wouldn't be able to get lost in a book like I used to be able to, because you just don't have that level of concentration. But one of the newest things that I've found I like doing is those little gem pictures. And I know I'm going to be judged for this, but they're about £4 on Amazon, and you basically just stick gems to a sticky picture. And yeah,
it brings you joy.
It does.
So this conversation today has been between some of the staff at the greenhouse and some of the parents who have access services at the greenhouse, or whose young people have access. Thank you so much for listening. We're really glad that you are. We'd also possibly love to see you in person if you live in the Bristol, South Gloss, North Somerset or Bath and North East Somerset areas, if that feels right for you. For any more information, we've got tons of stuff on our website, so head to www.the-green-house.org.uk for further info about our services and other services. And if you are worried about yourself or your child, please see your GP or think about contacting your local CAM service. Thanks again for listening, and also have a listen to some of the other conversations we've had.